Hello, and welcome to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, lead editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. In this episode, we talk with Chip Kahn, President and CEO of the Federation of American Hospitals. We talk about the financial climate of hospitals and what hospitals are expecting from Washington, the new administration, and Congress. He says health systems are worried about cuts affecting Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, and that could lead to more patients without coverage and more financial headaches for hospitals. It's a very interesting, wide-ranging discussion. Please join us. Well, thanks for joining us today. I'm Ron Southwick, lead editor of Chief Healthcare Executive, and this is another episode of Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. We are talking today with Chip Kahn, the president and CEO of the Federation of American Hospitals. Chip, thanks so much for taking time today.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
Hey, well, thankfully there's not much going on, so it'll be a very short conversation.
Right.
As we start a new year, there's obviously a lot of news happening, and obviously with the new administration coming in. Maybe just start as a first place. Let's talk about just how hospitals are doing. Obviously, a lot of hospitals had some really steep financial challenges with the COVID-19 pandemic. Some are starting to do better, some are still facing some headwinds. From your perspective, how are hospitals faring financially?
Well, let me say two things about it. So we're 5 years from COVID. So you could argue that we're into a next generation of healthcare and the healthcare market. I think that the recovery from COVID has been mixed in terms of the services provided or the care provided by hospitals, the volume of care I'm speaking of here. I think some have come back. Some patterns of care and patient volume has not come back or has been moderated. I think there was, in a sense, this influx of money that sort of helped during COVID also, I think probably masked to some extent the financial difficulties of some hospitals, and the hospitals that are well financed, well constituted in terms of their operations, they went through COVID fairly well, and most of them, the systems that I work for at the Federation of American Hospitals, the taxpaying systems, have come out of it and really gotten back to pre-2019 or pre-2020 volumes, activities, and actually even with some growth. I think some other hospitals haven't, but I don't know whether that was COVID or that was a trend that was already embedded. And also, there are just so many things going on with the healthcare system. I mean, we have tremendous changes in physician care, in the settings in which physicians practice. We have so much technological advancement and explosion, and we have so much that we can do now outpatient rather than inpatient. So we're at a point at which, finances, technology, patient expectations, the possibilities of medical care are all sort of mixing at the same time. And we look at it, and it is a very complex transition that we're going through.
A lot of hospital leaders I've talked to have said they still face challenges with recruiting and retention. From your perspective, what are you seeing or hearing from your members in terms of their staffing levels?
I think that in terms of basic nursing care and those others that are so critical to hospitals that support the patient care, that we're clearly out of the trough that was experienced in the wake of COVID. But I think it's a daily concern by all who administer and run hospitals. Staffing is an issue, an ongoing issue. I think now we're suffering, in a sense, from generational change, a lot of retirements that occurred, some prematurely because of COVID, some in terms of the natural cycle of things. So I think that's a factor. But I go back to my other point about medical care changing and evolving. That's a factor too, I think. But overall, we're staffed up. We're meeting the needs of the patients on the one hand. On the other hand, every day, making sure you meet those standards, is a challenge.
Well, we do have a new administration in Washington now. What are the Federation's priorities for the coming year with the new administration?
Well, we have a number of priorities, and I'd characterize, though, all of these priorities as coverage, coverage, coverage. It is so important for Americans to have health coverage. It just makes the care seamless, and it doesn't bring financial issues into the care that is so essential that patients need. Specifically, though, one of the policies that's made a real difference for so many are the tax credits in the exchanges, in the individual market. And we are now up to almost 25 million Americans in the exchanges. That can only be sustained if we continue these tax credits, these enhanced tax credits, I should say. They expire in 25. It's a top priority of ours to see them extended into the future. We'd like to see them made permanent, but if that's not possible in the legislative process, for our patients, we'll take whatever we can get. I mean, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years. Critically, a critical path for many, many, many patients, particularly in states that chose not to expand Medicaid. There are five or six states that where all the growth is, and Texas and Florida are right at the top of that. So critically important that those get extended. Second, the Medicaid program for healthcare and hospitals today is so important for so many lower income Americans. And it's just critical path too that that program be sustained. There are various aspects of the program that we know are under potential examination and maybe threat regarding legislative action or even administrative action to reduce Medicaid. And at least at this point, I think we need to hold our own with it. And then there are a myriad of issues with managed care. Today, in Medicare, managed care is MA is Medicare Advantage is 20, I mean, it's 55% of the program. If you look at the Medicaid programs for those on acute for acute care coverage, 70% of the program. And the denials, the delays, all this discussion around the issues that are raised by the administration of coverage by the health plans has, put a great squeeze on patients and those trying to provide care to the patients. And we need policies that deal with prior authorization, that deal with making sure that we're going to be reimbursed for the care that's been provided. We have other priorities. Obviously, there are issues in Medicare, but those are three of the top ones.
There's a lot to unpack right there. Let's talk about the exchanges and the Affordable Care Act and that the extra funding, which is slated to expire at the end of the year. Are you confident or at least sort of optimistic that there might be extensions there? Because this is an administration that's focusing on reducing spending. It seems like that might be an area that could take a hit.
At the end of the day here, I think the fact that that program, because of the tax credits, has grown to 25, almost 25 million Americans, probably go over that number in 20, in next year if the credits continue, and so critical for rural areas around the country and other areas. I mean, a lot of the growth is, not on the coasts. It's in those areas where there really are not other options for people, and this is it. They're not going to be eligible for Medicaid. So I think there's a compelling story here that will reverberate with policymakers, and so I'm hopeful that they'll take a positive read on a program that's become a critical part of our overall fabric of, I mean, in a sense, we don't have national health insurance, but we do have programs that sort of cover the entire waterfront of all Americans. And this is critical that we keep this program where it is.
If there is less people, fewer people covered under the Affordable Care Act, if there are cuts in Medicaid, is it safe to predict that that would lead to an influx of people showing up in hospital emergency rooms looking for care because they're not able to get care anywhere else?
Well, this is why health insurance is so important, because it allows those who are covered to get the care they need in the right setting. I mean, and that's really what you're describing, is this issue of making sure that people get the coverage the care they need at the right time in to meet their health care needs, to meet their medical needs. And yes, we are very worried that there'll be a boomerang here, because the people that need the care need the care. And if they're not able to afford health insurance, if health insurance becomes totally unaffordable to them, that doesn't mean they're not going to come back. And I come back into the system. They may come back into the system too late, or and even be and have their whatever care they need will end up more expensive than it otherwise would have been. So that's why it's so critically important that the tax credits, the enhanced tax credits, be extended, that Medicaid, be sustained at the levels that it's at now.
You mentioned Medicaid and rural health care, and I think that's something a lot of people don't understand. So I think sometimes people think of Medicaid supporting hospitals maybe in cities, maybe safety net hospitals in urban areas. I'm not, do you think people understand how important Medicaid is for funding rural hospitals and how some rural hospitals just won't survive without Medicaid?
There are many issues in rural America, economic issues, but the fact of life is that you tend to get older people and younger, lower income people in Americans in rural America. I mean, that's the story of rural America right now. The people in the middle who could move have moved, and so you look at rural hospitals today, and the share of their revenue that comes from Medicare, and particularly Medicaid, is so large, and those payments generally are under cost and under what they need to be. So it's very hard to make ends meet to provide the services in these rural areas. It's one of the reasons you've seen closures, but. And closures are horrendous for a town or a county. But also you've seen cutbacks in services, because services that can't pay for themselves have to be cut frequently, because there's not the grease in terms of the overall revenues of the hospitals in those areas to cover all those other services. To cover any losses they have in those services. That's why you have these OBGYN deserts in many areas. I can't, overstate, get it going back to my coverage, that's what it goes back to. And we've got to keep these programs going, and it doesn't even answer all the questions for rural health care. Like I said, the fundamentals weaken those providers in terms of the revenue they desperately need to cover the cost of care. And I obviously rural, I mean, urban areas have their issues, particularly inner cities, but The crisis today is rural America. Now, let me say that that also is the base of President Trump. And hopefully, the issues to meet the issues that come up to meet the challenges in those areas will be ones that the administration and the Republican Congress, which also represents to a great extent those parts of the country, they'll be responsive to those issues.
We should also talk about Medicare too, because obviously there's concerns about funding for hospitals, for physicians. It seems like, President Trump's indicating he's not going to be cutting Medicare benefits for recipients. Even if Medicare funding holds steady, though, that might not necessarily be good news for hospitals who've been frustrated with reimbursements from Medicare for a while. What are your expectations for funding for Medicare for hospitals?
Well, I think the biggest thing, the largest thing that's happening in Medicare, there's a lot of discussion about the CMMI, the experimental unit at CMS and value-based purchasing, and trying to change the program and make it more outcomes oriented. All that to me is not unimportant, but what is the key to the future of Medicare, if current trends continue, is the expansion of Medicare Advantage. I mean, the health plans now, like I said, have almost 55% of Medicare beneficiaries, and you look at projections, that's the biggest show in town in terms of Medicare. Well, that downstream does reverberate for hospitals, physicians, other providers who are the front line for care. And because of the arbitrage of the health plans, providers, whether they be hospitals or clinicians, are generally paid less by Medicare Advantage plans than they are by Medicare fee-for-service even. And this is a sensitive issue, but as long as the plans continue with this fight to maintain high levels of denials, delays, and it makes it really untenable for hospitals, clinicians, others to be in a constant battle. And it raises administrative costs because of all the costs of chasing after every dollar rather than having those dollars for patient care just paid to the hospitals. There's some other specifics in it. If you want me to get into, I can get into.
Go ahead. Yeah, let's dive in.
Well, I'm going to describe a policy that's sort of the it, it one. It's a big factor for hospital care, and second, it to me, it's sort of a tip of an iceberg of a problem. Not to get too technical, but a number of years ago, hospitals and CMS. On Medicare came to a compromise that if a patient was in a hospital for two midnights, 48 hours, and that they got sent upstairs and were basically inpatient, that and the doctor ordered it, that the Medicare on the fee-for-service side would pay for inpatient services for those two nights and for the stay. The MA plans have not recognized that. And so they would go to the farthest extent they could to keep a patient under observation rather than admitted as an inpatient because the payment for those two are quite different. Well, the patients we're talking about that came in with chest pains or whatever are up on the floor. They're receiving inpatient services. And you could get into a technical discussion. But at the end of the day, we have a Medicare policy that works on the fee-for-service side, which the health plans won't recognize. Well, Medicare did come in and say physician discretion is critical here, and the health plans have to recognize it. And depending on how you read the rules, you can say, well, this reflects to midnight. Well, the health plans still are doing their damnedest to try to avoid that simple rule. Which works. And so one of our priorities is to see CMS on, move on getting the plans to recognize to midnight But I said this is just one of the kinds of issues where hospitals, but I mean, if there are other issues with physicians, are in constant conflict with the health plans over what will be paid for the care.
There's been a lot of talk about prior authorization reform, including with Medicare Advantage plans. It hasn't really gotten over the hump yet in Washington with new administration, new in Congress. Do you see any reason to think that there might be a chance for some meaningful reform in prior authorization?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. There's sort of two avenues where that's a possibility. One, the previous administration did in its regulatory process in CMS put in reforms, but they're in a the, they're to get them to closure. There's a rule right now that's done annually that determines the premium levels for the health plans, and it includes some of the technical language that's needed to implement some of these reforms for prior authorization. The administration stalled that regulation, as it stalled all regulations, to review it. So I think that their decision there will be a leading indicator on what direction they want to take on prior authorization reform, and hopefully they'll continue the path that we've already begun. There is also legislation on the Hill, and there was with previous legislation that was drafted, there was a cost. See, a Congressional Budget Office said that it would increase Medicare costs. We think that that's been dealt with in the current drafts of legislation, and so I'm hopeful that Congress will return to this legislation when it gets warmed up, over the next couple of quarters, and maybe produce legislation that will reinforce the action that CMS is already hopefully will take.
Well, you mentioned Congress sort of just getting warmed up, but they have some pressing deadlines coming up. They passed the short-term spending bill that only goes into March, and that included some temporary waivers for telehealth and hospital-at-home programs, and they expire at the end of March. Do you see a strong possibility that there will be some extensions, longer-term, at least multi-year extensions for telehealth and hospital-at-home?
Well, let me go back and say that also there were extensions, critical path extensions for Medicare dependent hospitals and low volume hospitals, which both are very, very important for rural hospitals. And then there's also was a delay in certain disproportionate share cuts that were relevant to all across the board, but particularly sensitive in rural areas. My guess is that, or let me start by saying that there could be a controversy around March 15th, and maybe the government could close. Who knows? With the current White House, on the one hand. On the other hand, it won't. It's not going to be. That's not going to go forever. Maybe a few days. So I think that these extenders will get extensions. Whether or not they get extensions for a matter of months or get extensions for which they need for a matter for years to get them out of this cycle of being attached to bills that only go for a few months, which is not good for health policy, because these are not programs that are meant to be renewed on a monthly basis or a couple of month basis and have such uncertainty sitting out there with them. But yes, I mean, I think that and there's also the debt ceiling, which are all critical paths, have to be done. The debt ceiling has to be increased for the fiscal security of country. I think that in both those matters, the Republicans will have to negotiate with the Democrats. They can't pass that in the House with just Republican bill, Republican votes, because they won't get to 218. And hopefully, out of that, we'll get a longer term resolution for these, for the issues you mentioned and the ones I've mentioned.
With the uncertainty over some of these programs, whether it's the Medicare dependent hospital program or the telehealth and hospital at home programs, I mean, you mentioned these are not things that need to that should be renewed on a monthly or a quarterly basis. Is this sort of uncertainty over the funding picture hampering hospitals in some respects? Are you hearing any reports from some of your members saying we'd like to move forward with maybe some programs or services, but we're kind of putting them on hold until we know what funding we're going to get out of Washington?
Well, I think we've been carried along sufficiently in terms of these short-term bills that there is some sense of security for these programs, but I'm sure it's in the back of hospital administrator minds, their minds when they're doing their budgeting. And so we it needs to be dealt with. I mean, in a way that extends them and gets that off the table from a policy standpoint.
We're getting towards the end of our window, and I did want to ask a little less political question, but something that affects a lot of hospitals in terms of supply costs, but even supply chain resilience that we keep seeing. Seems like every few months there's some interruption in supplies. We saw it last year with the shortage of IV fluids. There's been a lot of interruptions in the supply chains for hospitals. How concerned are you about that resilience for hospitals and getting critical supplies that they need to operate day to day?
Well, you know, I've been at the Federation now in June 24 years. So I've seen a number of business and policy cycles. And you had drug issues before COVID, generic drugs, and that led to hospital systems taking action, forming Civitas Rx to produce some of their own drugs because of that. But it really has been in the COVID and post-COVID period that we've seen just a really tenuous situation for so many different supplies. And I think the group purchasing organizations and the hospitals have worked, you know, have really had Herculean efforts to meet this challenge. So I think that we have sort of a balance right now, but I think there's a lot of nervousness with the new administration, with the discussion of tariffs. I can't help but get political because there are just certain products and supplies that are critical to hospital care that are not going to get produced in the United States. They're just there's now I don't want to say at what point a tariff could go that it would make it financially viable to produce certain things, but it's just hard to envision. You know, we have to have a supply chain that goes, you know, goes to Asia. And so I think that nervousness, I won't quite say that, but there's a realization that that people have to be ready for contingencies because the direction is challenging.
Well, before we wrap up, I know we've covered a lot of ground and not a lot of time. And boy, the time has really flown on my end. Anything that we haven't talked about that's a priority or just an issue that you think is mentioning that we need to be thinking about could be affecting hospitals and health systems?
No, I'll just conclude by saying that I think that there are a lot of challenges from the new Congress and the new administration. Clearly, there's an issue around belt tightening on the one hand. On the other hand, I think the new administration really recognizes that there are costs that could be reduced because of regulatory burden and you know, some duplication of quality measures and other factors. And so I look forward, I don't think we should leave all negative in a negative note. I think we do have an opportunity with the change in Washington to hopefully have some regulatory relief that can help buffet, buffer some of the other increases in costs we have to deal with that could reduce costs. So I really look forward, and our association and our members look forward to working with the new administration to try to ferret out what's essential and what's not on the regulatory front in order of assuring patient care, assuring safety and quality services on the one hand, but also not burdening hospitals and having us jump through hoops for no good reason, other than that's just the way it's been done. So I'm optimistic that we can get some cost reduction from burden reduction, and that will impact patient care in a positive way, I think.
It's not going to be a dull year ahead for sure. So there's going to be a lot to see from watching where the opportunities might be for savings and some other opportunities as well, but also maybe some challenges ahead. So we'll keep our eyes open. But I want to thank Chip Khan from the Federation of American Hospitals for taking some time with us today. It's a great conversation. Thanks so much for joining us, Chip.
Oh, my pleasure to be here, Ronnie.
Okay. Thanks so much. And I'm Ron Southwick, Chief Healthcare Executive. Take care. Thanks for listening to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For the latest healthcare news, compelling features, and deeper dives, visit chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X. I'm Ron Southwick, lead editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Take care.